An important ingredient, of course, is confidence, hope, reassurance, faith, love, festivity, and a strong will to live. These have biochemical connotations. And therefore, if you treat a patient just in mechanical terms, instead of recognizing you're dealing with spiritually sensitive tissue, you're dealing with people with souls.
It's a whole other way of looking at life and being a doctor than most doctors are trained to. Because I think most doctors care at that level, but they don't have the training. Their training disassociates them, because to survive medical school, they have to go through such a desensitizing process. Would you agree?
Well, it's unfortunate that the medical curriculum is divided into hard and soft.
Right.
The hard subjects have numbers attached to them, and the students know that if they put down the right numbers, they're going to get the right grades and be that closer to their sheepskin. But on the other hand, the most important things in medicine have the onus of being soft. And this has to do with the way doctors relate to their patients, the way they inspire the patients, the way they help to activate the healing system of their patients, the way they know, as I said earlier, their powers extend beyond the prescription pad. These are very fine doctors. I had one such,
yes.
And we're lucky indeed when we have such a doctor.
That's why we can talk to you today, probably, at least one of the reasons. What I'm hearing you say, then, is it's not the events of the external world, it's not the microbe, but man himself that probably plays the biggest role in what happens to himself. Because the microbes are around us all the time, and yet why does one person come down with the virus, whereas if someone else is exposed to it, and their immune system fights it off?
That's right. We have these magnificent mechanisms inside us for warding off disease. Under circumstances of severe strain, or when the assault becomes very great, and our defenses are lowered, disease takes hold. But the wise physician never separates himself from the asset represented by the patient's own resources. And he prescribes in terms of those patient's resources. He prescribes out of the patient's own apothecary rather than just out of the drugstore on the corner.
Right. Well, the ultimate resources are always within the patient. So we're talking a little bit about how to harness that. Sometimes we harness those resources. In other words, an event comes and we believe something about it. And it seems like our communication to ourselves is going to determine that chemical reaction. It's going to determine how we respond. And part of that is the words we use. One of the things that I teach people is something I call transformational vocabulary. That is, if an event happens and you say, "That devastated me," there is a different biochemical reaction. There's at least a different emotional reaction, I know, than if you say, "This concerns me." So the doctor's language to the patient, as well as the patient's language to themselves, I would think would affect the healing process, would it not?
Tony, I'd like to underline the profound importance of what you've just said. In the past 12 years here, I think I've had a chance to work with maybe 1,800, 2,000 patients, most of them seriously ill. I think the most striking thing I observed during that period was that people became worse at the time of the diagnosis.
Yes.
The moment they had a word, you speak about language, the moment they had a word to attach to their symptoms, they became worse.
Yes.
Because they translated language into biochemical reality.
Yes.
There was a profound effect on the downside of what they now believed about themselves. Cancer means a certain thing.
Yes.
Multiple sclerosis means a certain thing. Heart disease, I now have heart disease. I'll never be able to do all the things I want to do in life. And this produces panic. Panic leads to helplessness. Helplessness leads to depression. And depression is a disease in itself, as you know.
Yes.
And depression can actually impair the workings of the immune system. We've been able to make measurements to show that the immune systems of depressed patients function at a much lower level. Conversely, we've been able to prove that if you can just liberate the patients from the depression produced by a diagnosis, by these words, just liberate the patient from the depression, there's an automatic boost in the body's own interleukins, the substance that helps to activate the immune system. So your point is quite correct. We communicate in terms of language. Values are attached to words.
Yes.
Words can produce illness. Words can kill. Therefore, the wise physician is very careful about the way he or she communicates. The wise physician will never give a flat-out diagnosis. The wise physician will never destroy the hope of the patient. If you do that, there's no point in treating. The wise physician is concerned about the environment of treatment and not just about the drugs that he or she uses.
I tell people that words have a biochemical effect, and that the label you put on your life's experience becomes your life experience. And I found it to be true at the level of emotions as well as the physical reality, and you certainly have more data to back that type of
thing.
Well,
the scientific evidence, Tony, is that the healing system is hooked onto the belief system.
Yes.
And that if you want that healing system to be fully functional, you've got to include belief. You've got to look at the total person. The moment you start thinking about any problem on the panic level, you move towards defeat. In biological terms, panic will constrict the blood vessels. Panic will produce alterations in one's hormones. You can get spurts of catecholamines. And when they hit the heart, they can actually rupture the muscle fibers of the heart. If we can just overcome the terror and begin to think in terms of our resources, not just the resources of the laboratory, but the resources of the body, we'll begin to make progress. I had a dentist visit me about a year and a half ago. He came with his lawyer because he wanted to leave his money to our program here at UCLA. And he wanted the lawyer to be able to get the correct wording for the will. He said he had AIDS, and he was getting ready to die because he was HIV. He'd received an HIV-positive diagnosis. Well, I told the dentist that I wouldn't talk to him about his will or to his lawyer about his will, but if he wanted to put up a fight, I'd be very glad to talk to him about that.
How wonderful.
And so we dismissed the lawyer, and I spoke to him about the fact that his body was not going to be totally destroyed, that even though it was true that the T4 cells were knocked out, by age you had other immune cells, and the body has this backup capacity and tendency. And also, the way in which he thought about it would have a great deal to do with the way his own resources could be mobilized. And by way of helping him to recognize that he wasn't helpless, we put him through the psychological exercise we give to cancer patients. When we prove to them that they have some degree of control over their autonomic nervous system, we set him down in this easy chair, had him close his eyes, and let him through a series of exercises, culminating in the order to move his blood around to different places in his body. We attached a thermometer to his hand, and when he saw that he had the actual power to increase the surface temperature of his skin by 10 degrees.
In his hands.
Yes, in his hands. He became electric with excitement.
Yes.
And now, therefore, the helplessness, which is the most serious part of the AIDS disease because it cripples the body, helps destroy the defenses. Since he had this realization that he was not without some measure of control and could replace his helplessness, important things began to happen. He came back to the office 3.5 months later with a letter from his physician saying that he was no longer HIV positive. He kept pursuing these exercises.
How come we don't hear about this?
Well, as I say, it's important for the people to know that we can have a response. The notion of 100% fatalities is not only erroneous but dangerous. Now, I don't want to suggest that anyone who has AIDS can get out of it just by the way he thinks.
Right.
What I'm trying to suggest is that we're not altogether without means. We've got to put up a fight, but we have more to work with than we think. I don't think that we should deny the diagnosis, but I think we should defy the verdict and have a blazing determination to overcome. And that blazing determination actually helps to mobilize the immune system. Dr. Solomon here at UCLA has been able to demonstrate that even though the T4 cells are knocked out, that there is actually an increase in other components of the immune system, and that these can perform a very useful function. We have far greater resources for meeting the challenge than we've been told or led to believe, and also that we're not locked in.
Yes.
There is a way of fighting back. We can reach for the best that is possible.
I agree.
And I don't think we ought ever to accept, as I say, any pronouncement of doom.
I agree. Let's talk about some of the emotions that potentially provide healing. It's known for years that certain emotions could certainly have a devastating effect on the body. What are the ones that you've researched most specifically, and what are the impacts on the body that we've been able to document?
One of my reasons for coming to UCLA 12 years ago was precisely because there's a great deal of research that had been done on the effects of the negative emotions, and medical science had a rather clear ideas about those effects, how they originated, and what happened as a result. But very little work can be done on the positive emotions, hope, faith, love, will to live, festivity, purpose. It didn't seem to me reasonable to believe that the only time the emotions make our registrations on our physiology are when the emotions are negative. And so for the past 12 years, both here and at other medical centers throughout the country and the world, medical scientists have been probing in this area, and there's no longer any doubt about the fact that the positive emotions do have specific effects, salutary effects, that the body's own pharmacy can be activated as a result of these positive emotions and negated under circumstances of the negative emotions. We have these vast powers. As William James said, these powers exist. It's unfortunate that we don't understand that they exist or that we possess them.
Yes.
But they're there and they're there to be used.
That's great. I know in your book you talked about the challenge of physician-induced diseases and challenges that come about there, and you talked about how language was a part of that, that the way we communicate can be a part of that, and it's not usually noticed. Certainly a physician never has that intent. How can this message be delivered to physicians so that it's important enough for them to really believe in and utilize? What's your mission? How do you believe that can be accomplished?
Well, before we do that, let's look at some examples of this, because okay. A lot of it is a result of carelessness or thoughtlessness. There are the parents of a child here who had leukemia, and they asked the doctor about the child's chances, and he said, well, it's hard to say, but I want you to promise me to give that you're going to give me the child's liver.
Oh. Well, I've heard some. I think you quoted one in your book where they told the 5-year-old girl's parents were told you should order the color of the satin on her coffin.
Yes.
Obviously, those are hopefully the exceptions. I don't think most physicians come from that place.
That's right.
How do we get through and make sure that this message is really heard there? Or what is your game
plan?
Well,
see, one of the problems, of course, is that too many physicians are educated by their lawyers to leave no doubt about anything that can happen on the downside.
Yes.
Fearful that if it does, that the physician might be in line for a malpractice suit.
It's unfortunate.
And unfortunately, this has led some doctors to dramatize the worst.
Yes.
But the telling the worst has a tendency to bring on the worst because it can be believed. And I can think of nothing more important that the School of Medicine can do than to teach doctors how to communicate properly. Of course we can tell the truth. You have to tell the truth. But I think you can tell the truth in a way that challenges. And you can always tell the truth in a way that leaves some hope. If you're not going to do that, there's no point in treating.
Yes.
The doctor who treats must recognize that a vital part of that treatment is to create an atmosphere and an environment in which treatment is possible. But if you're going to destroy that environment, then you might just as well close your black bag.
Interesting. Where do you see the patient in the healing process then? We've talked a lot about the doctor, but is the ultimate doctor not the one inside each of us?
A great deal is said about patient responsibility, and here again I'm afraid that language tends to produce confusion.
Yes, I agree.
The word responsibility
can be a weighted word, yeah.
To many people means that the patient brought on the illness, or rather willed it. You don't want people to feel guilty about their illness, obviously.
I agree.
And that's the worst possible environment of treatment. But on the other hand, the word responsibility can also mean that the patient must share in the work that has to be done to get away from illness. The patient has the healing system. The patient's fears, the patient's panic may inhibit the functioning of that healing system. Therefore, it's important for the patient to recognize that, first, that no one knows, no doctor knows enough to make a pronouncement of doom. That so long as remissions are reported in the medical journals, no doctor can really make a flat prediction. Otherwise, there would be no such reports in the medical journals. And that hope is reality, but also that hope is a powerful factor in overcoming serious disease. Again, we move along the path of expectations. Hope makes it possible to create an environment in which the doctor can do his best. Hope makes it possible for the patient to program himself or herself to get the most out of treatment. We've had patients, for example, who had such severe reactions to chemotherapy, the nausea and the blisters and everything else that went with it, that the chemotherapy had to be discontinued. But when you take some of those same patients and teach them to approach the experience of chemotherapy not in the mood of the informed consent that the informed consent paper creates. And that, those informed consent papers are documents of doom.
Yes.
They tell a patient the worst, and the patient believes the worst. But if you can just set aside those expectations and get the patient to approach these procedures in a mood of thanksgiving, that it's wonderful to be living in a time when science has put this at our disposal and gives us a better chance, a real chance, and that we can program ourselves for good result. We are reaching out, and we're going to make good use of what we receive. We discover those same patients who before went through these devastating experiences were able now to tolerate the drug. Human beings are bundles of uniqueness. We've got these vast resources. We must understand them and put them to work.
Yes, I agree. I think most people just don't realize that belief is physical, that it's real. You gave a great example in your book having to do with here in Los Angeles where people thought there was food poisoning. Maybe you could relate that story.
That happened at the Monterey Park football stadium.
Yes.
And several persons reported ill during the game with symptoms of food poisoning, and the examining physician questioning these persons was able to ascertain that they'd all consumed Coca-Cola from the dispensing machine onto the stands.
So I assume that was the cause.
Well, he naturally wondered whether there was some fermentation of the syrup or
right.
contamination, or since the dispensing machines were connected to copper piping, he wondered whether copper sulfate had leaked into the drink. And he had to make a precise determination about the cause, but meanwhile, he didn't want others to be exposed. And because of the possibility that it might be the soft drink, since all these people had soft drinks, he caused an announcement to be made requesting that no one patronize the dispensing machine. Some persons become ill, and the symptoms were described. The entire stadium became a sea of retching and fainting people, including those who had not gone near the machine.
Wow.
And five ambulances had to ply back and forth between hospitals and the stadium. And then it was discovered the dispensing machine was innocent and people became suddenly recovered. So what we think has a great deal to do with who we are, what we are, and what's wrong with us. But it could also have a great deal to do with what's right with us.
Yeah, no kidding. Maybe the mind is the ultimate tool, and whatever you think, you'll get delivered into
your life. It's certainly
the
ultimate apothecary.
Yes, no doubt, no doubt. I know in Anatomy of an Illness, you described that there were questions, and in Head First, you say these are the answers. What are the answers in summary that you found, and where do you go from here?
I'm afraid that the publisher, in describing in these terms, made it a little more complete than it was.
Right.
Many other questions, of course, that remain to be answered. And this whole field of mind-body studies is just now opening up. We're just beginning to discover the powers of the mind, to be able to identify the biochemistry and the pathways. Just beginning. We're just beginning to discover the possibilities. Well, there's enough work out there to keep one reasonably engaged for a long time to come.
What are some of the most important things you learned then from everything you've done thus far, from your own illness? If you were going to summarize, say, the most important half dozen points, or distinctions or beliefs that you developed, what are they?
As I said earlier, don't deny the diagnosis. Defy the verdict.
Right.
Second, realize that we're stronger than we think. We've been educated for weakness. Everything we've heard about in the field of health points in the direction of what is wrong. We don't know how beautifully robust we are. I can think of no more important lesson in education than to teach people how beautifully constructed the human body is and how it can serve its purposes. We've got to have confidence in ourselves and to recognize that illness is not something that is to be feared. It comes with life. You can't get through this lifetime without it. But we can meet it often enough to give us confidence in it. I think that we ought to recognize that there are possibilities of joy in every experience, that the capacity to be joyful imposes almost the responsibility to be joyous. There's a great deal out there. Life is infinitely precious, but infinitely fragile and infinitely strong under varying circumstances. I think I've learned that the tragedy of life, the great tragedy of life, is not death, but what dies inside us while we live. Therefore, the need to be fully alive is within our reach. Well, I can think of a wide range of lessons to be learned. One of the most important of which is that the basic drive of life is for regeneration, and it must be respected, it must be nurtured, and must be invoked. There's enough that happens in the newspapers to provide discouragement if we're looking for it, but at least in terms of our ability to meet challenges, our ability to find challenges, we have vast resources, and these resources can become a philosophy of life and not just an abstract asset.
That makes total sense. I appreciate you sharing that. I don't think most people know what a Renaissance man you really are. Are you a person who met with Ernest Hemingway and Dr. Albert Schweitzer? Your writings are prolific. You just shared with me earlier that you've just written a new play that's just coming out. You're a father, you're a grandfather, you're an example of possibility. How do you want to be remembered in your life? I like asking easy questions.
And you know, it's an interesting question. Someone perhaps who helped people to dispel their panic about life. Someone who tried to introduce people to their own potentialities. This is what you've been doing, Tony. Someone who, in helping people to conquer their fears, helped to release their resources.
Yeah. God bless you. Thank you for being such an example of what's really possible for the human spirit and for the body.
Thank you, Tony.
Well, what do you think? Norman Cousins. Can you see why he was one of my heroes and still is? Now, here's a man who, you know, I shared this interview with you for the very reason he lived the purpose of his life. Maybe to remind you that you're not fragile, that you're not just a victim of your environment, that yes, germs and things are all around us, but our mind and bodies work together. And if we take control of those two forces, especially our mind, we can conquer fear and we can have the vitality and life and health that we deserve. He lived 16 more years beyond the diagnosis of his death, and he lived vital years that contributed to so many people. So let's move on, shall we? Let's now move to another extraordinary human being who can give you insight into the inherent power, the healing power of your mind and body and your spirit working together, Dr. Deepak Chopra.
This program continues on the next CD.